Hello, everyone. This is Rillian.
And this is Glumpuddle. Hello.
And we are reading The Silver Chair.
And the voice was not like a man's. It was deeper, wilder, and stronger, a sort of heavy, golden voice. It did not make her any less frightened than she had been before, but it made her frightened in rather a different way. "Are you not thirsty?" said the lion. "I'm dying of thirst," said Jill. "Then drink," said the lion.
All right. Now, I think, I believe, Rillian, that the first time you read the series, Silver Chair was your favorite, which it,
it
is mine.
Was.
It was mine
initially,
as well.
Initially, it was my favorite. And by the way, just so everyone knows, this is going to be the most difficult book to discuss for one reason only. Two reasons, actually. First of all, Glumpuddle chose a name that I'm convinced will trip me up, I'll say at least a dozen times through this series. And plus, there's Rillian, so maybe we should talk about, I don't know, Prince Rillian versus Rillian. But anyway,
well,
that'll be
we'll
still, interesting, because we both chose names from the Silver Chair. It
we'll
says something how... that we both chose names from the Silver Chair.
Yeah. Silver Chair is a really, it's a significant book in the series because it's the middle book, if we're reading in publication order, which I know Rillian and I certainly are.
Yeah.
And so it's the middle book in the series, and it represents a big, I think, a huge shift in the series, where the first three books didn't have a clearly defined main character, and beginning with The Silver Chair, all the books after this do.
Because there's some, like, if you were to, you sort of think, oh, you know, with, like, if let's say The Voyage of the Dawn Treader had been, you know, amazing, you know, who, you know, and everyone had gotten Oscar nominations, who would have been best actor and versus best supporting actor? You know, there's not a really clear... you know,
right?
Oh, who's the main person? It's similar to like the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Is Peter a bigger male character or is Edmund? You know, and so, but this would be very clear. You know, well, whoever played Jill would be the best actress, and then you'd have, you know, maybe best actor might almost would probably be Eustace, and then Puddleglum would be the supporting. But it's sort of interesting because I think that Lewis has, I like to just see variety in style, and I've said this before, and I don't need to harp on it anymore, but I just do like to see variety in structure and style and how he tells a story like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which has, or Prince Caspian, which has a lot of characters that it follows.
Yeah, it does.
Versus then even something like Silver Chair or The Horse and His Boy, which has a, more of a clear main character.
Like, and that kind of brings me to my first little piece of unasked for advice to the filmmakers, which I'm sure we'll be throwing in since, you know, this is the Silver Chair book commentary, but since the Silver Chair movie's in development, it'll be difficult for us not to mention at least here and there some things about the movie. And my first unasked for piece of advice to the filmmakers is to keep Jill Pohl the main character. Make this Jill's movie and be very much from her perspective. Be number one for me. I think she's the emotional center of the whole thing, and the way she's introduced here, first line of the book, it was a dull autumn day and Jill Pohl was crying behind the gym. And then first off, Lewis does something he does for all the other books, which is the first couple pages are just setting up here's a certain environment, here's a certain place, and just kind of getting a feel for it. In this case, it's Jill's school, which, as Lewis puts it, is not a pleasant subject, and basically she has no one she can possibly trust. She doesn't seem to have any friends. There's all kinds of horrible things going on, all kinds of injustice going on in her school that she's a victim of. Even the head and leaders there can't do anything about it, or at least aren't doing anything about it. And it was pointed out to me by a fellow Narnia fan that Jill is the only of the main human characters in the series is the only one whose parents are never mentioned. Was that intentional by Lewis, or just an accident? I don't know. But there's never any mention of her parents at all. That's just an observation, but...
You could simply say that as Jill goes through her musings, her parents aren't... Whatever her background is, her parents aren't...
They don't seem to be present. Yeah,
they're not at the forefront.
Mm-hmm. And she just seems... She's just in a hopeless situation, whereas weeks and weeks of the term ahead of them, of her and Eustace... So that's where we find Jill. By the way, I really like how Eustace is introduced, where you don't know it's him initially.
Yeah.
It's just a boy rounds the corner.
Mm-hmm. And then it's almost, and of course he gives kind of a mini introduction, which he does almost in every book, because he tries to make every book self-sustaining. And I don't know why it seems to be with the Silver Chair, but for some reason, a lot of people, it seems, I just hear anecdotally, start with the Silver Chair.
Really?
Yeah, I just heard of people who, that's the, for some reason, you would think like if they're in an alternate to Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, it would be The Magician's Nephew, but they start with the Silver Chair. For like maybe that's the only book they find and they buy. I'm not saying it's a large percentage of people. I'm just saying that of all the people I've heard of who start with a book other than The Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, it seems to be almost more The Silver Chair. Like that's a book that just is out. I think it's maybe just out there. I don't know.
The Silver Chair, in some ways, it does feel like a new start to the series because Jill's our main character, and she's a lot. This is all new to her. We're really seeing it from her perspective. I think if this is our first Narnia book, we'd be introduced to a lot of things at the same, including Aslan, at the same time that Jill is.
Mm-hmm. But it also it still turns people onto the series, and it's still an introduction.
Yeah.
For all of that it is.
But I like how it ends up pretty much where Dontari left off, where there was that comment at the end about how much Eustace has changed, and that's really what Jill's talking about, where initially mm-hmm. she's mad at him and says, oh, you've been a beast, and blah, blah, blah. But then she says, you know what, yeah, you really have changed. Well, what's so different about you?
Well, what I also like, in just reading it today, there's just a sense that the things that Eustace is talking about, he might not have even done at the end of Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
What do you mean?
Just the things that he mentions, though, didn't I stand up for this person? Didn't I, keep this secret?
Yeah, he's talking about things he did recently.
This
that
new
he would
school
not have
term,
done before Dawn Treader.
Right. The things this, things that he's done this new school term. But you almost get the sense that just the way the characters progressed in that time, that you know he's continued to grow, continued to mature.
Absolutely.
And these aren't necessarily even things. I just kind of get the sense, and maybe this is just me, that these things he's mentioning, maybe he wouldn't have even done at the end of Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
Yeah.
That he's continued to change as a person, and
absolutely.
He just strikes me
Lewis said he began to be a different boy,
and so I think it's just one of those little nuanced aspects of his character development that you see here.
It's funny about how you talked about some people reading The Silver Chair first, and that's kind of interesting to me. If you think about this scene, I wish I could erase my brain and read The Silver Chair again as book one, because like this scene, this would be kind of an intriguing opening. Like, who's this boy who, he was really mean before, and now he's nice, and he's hinting that, well, I've been to another world, and that might be kind of a really intriguing, you know, we read Dawn Treader, we already know that. But if you just read The Silver Chair, that would be a really intriguing kind of mystery and hook. And, well, what's he talking about? And we'll find, oh, there's actually a lot of truth to what he said. That'd be awesome. If you read The Silver Chair as book one, post a comment or let us know. So Eustace wants to get to Narnia. And so they try doing this really, you know, Jill wants to, you know, draw circles and, you know, draw a circle or whatever, and Eustace is like, oh, I don't think that would work. And so they hold out their arms and say, Aslan, 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 you know, please let us come into your world. And then shortly after they hear some bullies coming, they run off and open that door that they're sure to be locked. They open it and they find themselves in another world. So here's the question. And this brings us to our first audio question. This is something we're going to start doing. Why don't you explain that, really, and what we're going to be doing?
Well, I think it'd be... You know, we want this to be the Narnia Web podcast.
Uh-huh.
And obviously, there's podcasters and people who are regulars on here. But we wanted to make it a little more...
interactive.
I'll say interactive, yeah. And a little more inclusive to everyone else. So if you send us an audio clip with you asking questions, introduce yourself and then ask the question. And it's going to be like this. And we're going to start doing this from now on. And people can send in their questions. And yeah, so we're going to start doing this in our first... is from our very own Jim Fan.
Hi, Narnia Web Podcast. It's Jim Fan from Chicago. My question is, given the events at the beginning of The Silver Chair, do you think it's possible that you can wish yourself into Narnia? Thank you.
Thank you, Jim Fan. By the way, Jim Fan just recorded that on her iPhone with the voice recorder app and then emailed it. It was super easy. So you can record yourself on your computer or your phone or, you know, whatever. And I'd say probably keep it to about, you know, I'd say keep it under about 60 seconds or so. We won't be super strict on it, but I would say don't go probably any longer than a minute as a general goal. But so what I think Jim Fan is getting at here is an issue. It's actually not as big. I always a little surprised it wasn't hadn't been discussed more by fans, but can you get to Narnia by trying, or by wishing yourself to Narnia, as she put it. And this is something I believe I first heard suggested by Douglas Gresham. He just kind of mentioned it in passing and said, you can't get to Narnia by trying. And at first, my thought was, wait, what are we talking about? Then as I thought it through, I decided, yeah, it seems like Lewis never does say it, but there are no examples, I believe, there are no examples in the Chronicles of someone saying, I want to go to Narnia, and then doing it. But the reason I think she's mentioning it here is because this seems like an exception. Now, we've talked about this before. What's your perspective on this?
My first thought is to go to, in my copy of the book, it was we who asked to come here. Scrub said we were to call to somebody. It was a name I wouldn't know, and perhaps that somebody would let us in. And we did, and then we found the door open. You would not have called to me unless I had been calling to you, said the lion. And in addition to that, you, of course, have the professor saying, you know, telling
the four
children at the end of the line, the words of wardrobe, don't go about trying.
And don't try to get there at all. It'll happen when you least expect it.
And I think that to a certain extent, within the mechanisms of the story, there's one aspect where, yes, it is a surprise. It's not something that they can just wish about and command because they're not the ones in control.
Yeah, apparently Aslan has to call to them first. Aslan, right. You have to be, whatever exactly that means, Aslan has to invite you first, I guess, essentially.
Right. And also, I can imagine, I know that, I mean, just hearing Eustace talk and you think about the other children, you can imagine that they would have wanted to go back, that they were that whole time wishing they could go back. Okay, and that they've been wishing they could go back that whole time. They didn't have there's no key you can, you know, plug into a wall and open. But so they really, I think, were already wishing they could go back, but it didn't change that. And also them wishing they could return when Aslan said, you can't return anymore, didn't change that.
Again, Lewis never actually says, he never makes it super clear if this is true. It's all sort of hinted at, and you could argue about whether or not this is consistent or inconsistent with the books. But basically, Lucy's first adventure, she goes to the wardrobe, and of course, when she steps into the wardrobe, you know, she has no idea there's going to be a magical world. She's totally shocked when she finds there's something in there. Then she comes out of the wardrobe. Oh, it's the Fawn. It's Tumnus. Come look, guys. And they can't get in. And so that got me thinking, well, why couldn't they get in? And I've never, you know, Lewis never does explain why that is. And I believe it's because you can't get to Narnia by trying. You can't intentionally do it. But then you look at the next example with Edmund, and people will think, well, yeah, Lucy, she totally got in by trying there, didn't she? And actually, no. If you read it, that's during the hide-and-seek game. So she does go in there with the intention of getting to Narnia. Then she hears footsteps, and she thinks it's Susan coming to catch her, because Susan is it. So she jumps into the wardrobe with the intention of hiding. And I just think it's really interesting that Lewis wrote it that way. Because if he did not like the movie, because with the movie, Lucy absolutely gets into Narnia by trying. She brings her candle, and she just opens the door and gets in. It's almost a little weird that Lewis didn't write it that way, because that would be a lot more obvious. Why did he write it in such a way that, you know, if she wasn't exactly trying to get there,
it's almost like he teaches
in
them a lesson. Like, in the last battle, what are they doing? They're trying to get the rings.
Yeah, now that's an example of them actually trying to do it. And we'll never know for sure what would have happened if they'd
actually touched the rings. Right, but they don't even get a chance to try in the last battle.
Uh-huh.
They're just thrown in.
So we'll never know for sure what would have happened if they'd have touched the rings. Would they just not been able to get there?
Right.
And
there's the magician's nephew, where...
they jump into the pool trying to get to Charn, and to their surprise, find themselves in Narnia.
That's true.
So it's still an accident. I don't know what's so special about Narnia as opposed to the other worlds where you can't get there by trying, but obviously with Charn, apparently you can.
Yeah.
But I just think that this may seem so nitpicky. If you disagree, please post a comment. I just don't think there's any examples in the series where this is contradicted. Obviously, Prince Caspian, Don Treader, total accidents. But the Silver Chair is a common one where people say, this has to be an example. You know, they're putting out their arms and saying, Aslan, please let us come into your world.
But also Aslan directly addresses it. He basically says, you were trying, but the reason why you were trying.
But even so, I think that when they open that door, Narnia was the last thing on their minds. They were trying to get away from some bullies. And I'm just saying... It would have been – Lewis always has that little loophole in there where, okay, they weren't necessarily getting there by trying, you know, in that moment. I can't say this is definitely true, but I think, you know, some of the lines, like with the professor and Aslan, you said kind of hint at it, and I don't believe there's anything in the series that contradicts it. So, Jim Fan, I don't believe it is possible to get to Narnia just by wishing it. I mean, I think even if there's a chink, one of those chinks and chasms, one of those magical, or the wardrobe, I believe any theory you have, in my opinion, has to answer the question, why is it that Lucy could get through the wardrobe the first time, but when she showed the others, the way was closed? That's a really key question, I think, if you want to put forth your own theory. So, we're in Aslan's country.
Here's a quick question for you. Did you think that Eustace died? As you're reading this, were you old enough to remember?
Did I think Eustace died? Well, he...
You don't really have time to think about it,
just like
Jill.
You don't really have time to process that. I remember going like, what? Like, when he fell, I was like, huh? I was like, I can't believe that just happened. And you know, Aslan comes to the rescue and starts blowing into Narnia before you really have time to process it. But there was definitely a shocking moment when I went, whoa. Just plummeting to the depths, or however Lewis writes it. You know, it's not at all what you expect to happen.
Right, right.
But then the lion appears, Jill gets thirsty, and goes looking for him, and we come to what might be my favorite scene in the entire series.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm trying to think of... I'm not going to try right now, on the spur of the moment, to go through all my favorite scenes. I will say this, and this is one of the great things you get throughout the Chronicles, where you have different characters that get little introductions to Aslan. You know, Trumpkin gets kind of a little introduction to Aslan. Eustace gets a very real introduction to Aslan. And every time you get these different characters that are introduced to Aslan, it's like a new introduction. It's not just like, you know, if you introduce a friend to your father, you don't really necessarily learn more about your father because you're introducing your friend to him because you know him so well, you know. But but when you see, it's almost like you're being introduced by this character to this person that you've met just a few times. And so,
There are movies that I've seen a million times, but when I watch them with somebody else, I kind of feel like I'm seeing it for the first time because I'm seeing it through their eyes.
Yeah, and it gives you a new vantage point. Now, I will say this is one of the, maybe the most, I'll say most interesting introductions to Aslan. Just the line, I know you'll probably want to read it. I don't want to steal your thunder. about that really demonstrates he's not a tame lion, and it's one of those things you wonder if, you know, if someone were to, this would be one of those lines that someone might try to do away with because it sounds so harsh.
Yeah. Aslan behaves in a really unexpected way here. And actually, this brings us to an email we got from Manise. Sorry if I'm saying that wrong. M-A-N-I-S-E, Manise. An email we got where they said, "The Silver Chair is my favorite book out of the Narnia series. A few things worry me about its adaptation, however. Jill meeting Aslan. I was totally taken aback by his behavior when I read this for the first time, and I'm concerned about how this will be handled. I mean, Aslan is sort of indifferent towards Jill. How should this be filmed? Would you change the lines, add lines? Did BBC do a good job? Let me know. Thanks." Thank you for email, Manise. What I really like is how Manise says it was totally taken aback by Aslan's behavior. And that's one of the things I love about this scene. You know, Jill is dying of thirst, and basically Aslan refuses to say, no, I'm not going to eat you. Even though we have a sense of, okay, Aslan's, you know, he's not safe, but he's also good.
She's the main character. We kind of know that she's
right.
Not going to.
And also, we don't think Aslan's going to eat her. Although, honestly, over the course of this scene, I think I remembered kind of wondering, wait, is he going to eat her or do something? Because he refuses to just come out and say it. You know, she's,
right.
First Jill says, will you promise not to do anything if I do come? And he says, I make no promise. So she asks him, do you eat girls? Which is initially kind of an amusing line, you know, like it's kind of cute, like, oh, that's kind of a funny question. But then Aslan's response is, I have swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realms. And then Lewis writes, it didn't say this as if it were boasting, nor as if it were sorry, nor as if it were angry. It just said it.
Yeah. No, that's such a great line.
How literal do you think that line is? Well, what's your interpretation of that line? I started a thread about this sometime last year, I think.
Well, I literal versus taking the verse literal, the line literally versus taking it at face value is a little different. But she's asking, is he going to eat me? I don't think he's saying eat, but I think he's saying, has he brought those things to destruction? Yes. I mean, you can think about worlds like Charn, you know, that have withered away and are gone. And you think about the course of events in worlds like that. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, why not? Why would not Aslan, depending on the circumstances and what was going on, destroy your boys, girls, women, men, cities? It's not a very tame statement. It's not cuddly.
I mean, he's basically trying to scare her. In addition to refusing to comfort her.
But he's not angry, and he's not saying it like
he just
a
says
threat.
It.
He's just answering your question.
Yeah.
Yes.
But so I think that this is in response to the question, do you eat girls? And I think he's essentially saying, yes, I have eaten girls. In fact, I've eaten a lot more than just girls. So, like when he said, I believe Aslan actually has swallowed up girls and boys. Actually, I believe he actually has eaten them. He could just mean he's destroyed them, or he's, you know, done something lethal to them or whatever. He may just be, you know, maybe he doesn't literally mean swallow, but I believe he does. That's just the sense I get, because this is in response to the question, do you eat girls? When he says cities and realms, does he mean he's actually swallowed an entire realm, like an entire planet at one time? I mean, like at the end of the last battle, is that Aslan swallowing up an entire realm, or does he mean this literally? Like, he's actually put a realm in his mouth, or does he just mean all the people I've eaten? Like the accumulated number of people is like an entire, would fill an entire realm, you know? I don't know how literal he is there, but I do believe, since he's responding to the question, do you eat girls? Aslan's saying, I put in a lot of people in my mouth and swallowed. I believe that. I think it almost wouldn't quite be satisfying the question if he was talking about something else, you know?
Yeah.
So this scene is basically, I think, once again, I was talking before about how Jill is a character who can't trust anyone. And now she's having to actually trust that Aslan, this lion who she's never met before, is not going to eat her, even though he's refusing to make it easier for her. I think that's why he refuses to comfort her. He's kind of making it as difficult as he can. And so this is a baby step for Jill in her journey learning to trust again. I say baby step because she only trusts Aslan because the only other option is dying of thirst. So this is a baby step towards learning to trust Aslan. And then in a second, and I think, you know, Manise talked about, you know, Aslan kind of acting indifferent towards Jill. And I suspect what he's talking about is Lewis writes, well, this is when Jill first sees Aslan. And Lewis writes, she knew at once it had seen her, for its eyes looked straight into hers for a moment and then turned away as if it knew her quite well and didn't think much of her. Which, I love that line. My interpretation of that is basically that Aslan knows that Jill has some issues, and it's about time to deal with them. I don't necessarily see it as indifference, but maybe it is a bit of a sigh. It's kind of like, you've got some issues, but you've got to sort out those trust issues, Jill. We got to do it right now, and you're the one I've chosen to find Prince Rillian for that reason. You know, at the end, yeah,
because
he needs her to learn this
perspective on it, because I think. I think the message here and what kind of surprises Jill is, and this is sort of the way our human nature is, we tend to think that we're the most interesting thing in the room. And really, you could say this really about almost all the children. Everyone just kind of expects, even if it's the Pevensies at the end of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's sort of, where's Aslan? And Mr. Beaver says, well, he has other...
He has other countries
to attend to. You know, he'll be here and he's gone because he has other things to do. And it's sort of
like swallowing up realms. He has other realms to swallow up.
I got a few realms to swallow before sundown. But you watch, you just read this and you think, I mean, on one hand, of course, yes, he knows Jill. Of course, he knows she's there. He's aware of her. But it's almost like, you know, you're not the main focus in my life right now. I have other things that I have. My mind on, and I just kind of like that because it's not all about you, which Jill has kind of been in this mode thus far in the story, that all of her concerns are about what's happening to her, and she is an unfortunate person. There's been some nasty things going on, but it is kind of a jolt of, oh, here's someone who's not devoting all their attention to me.
Mm-hmm. But I also wonder if Aslan is basically kind of waiting for her to drink. You know, it's like. I think he's, well, yeah, she's going to have to trust me. She's going to have to bend down and drink even though I'm here. Because then he pauses for a moment. I almost wonder if he's thinking, okay, seriously, I'm going to have to, like, you can't just go and drink even they're dying of thirst. I'm going to have to, he has to actually tell her, if you're thirsty, you may drink, you know, as if, you know, you're dying of thirst. You should just do that. You need the water. So she does bend down and drink the water, but only because she's dying of thirst. And then Aslan gives her this task of the four signs, which are kind of vague and a little weird, and she's going to have to trust them, even though they sound a little strange, and they're coming from a lion she's never met, and it's really intimidating, and has swallowed up girls and realms, you know, has swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realms. So it's quite a task for Jill. This is a Jill of all people. This is a really difficult task. And I really like how the four signs, I think they're a great sort of teaser for the rest of the book. After I read about the four signs, I really want to finish the book because I want to see what they're going to look like, especially the one about the writing on the stone. I find that real. I want to see what it says and what does Aslan mean by that. And the four signs, to me, are one of the best like hooks in the series. If you can make it past chapter two of The Silver Chair, you're going to want to finish it because you're going to want to know what the signs are going to look like.
Well, especially, and this is, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but the one where you hear about the stone and the message in the city, and then you think, and even in that part of the story, when you actually see it, you're thinking, what?
Uh-huh.
Why is that there?
Uh-huh. And then, the fourth one about, you're going to know the prince because he'll be the first person you meet on all your journey to ask you to do something in my name. So, which is one of the clearest indications, probably the clearest indication in the series that Aslan actually knows the future. But anyway, this is a wonderful scene. Another piece of advice, unasked for advice, I'll give to the filmmakers about this scene since it's my favorite. Number one, it absolutely does set up the plot of the entire book, but it is first and foremost a character-driven scene. It's about Jill learning to trust. And I can picture the filmmakers kind of doing what they did with the scene with the professor in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah.
Where he just quickly outlines the three points. Yeah, Lucy, she's either telling the truth or she's mad or she's...
I know that my favorite scene probably in all of the BBC films was the professor scene with Peter and Susan. I thought it was made probably the most well-pulled-off scene there. And this is a scene I would just say, yeah, keep the dialogue verbatim. Why not?
It's hard to say until you see what they've done with the tone of the story and the pacing and all that. But in general, yeah, this scene seems like it could work. And what I would just caution the filmmakers about is I can just see them saying, okay, I'm Aslan, here's the four signs, go. And just like getting what we need for the story out of the way. And it's not about that. It's about the emotional impact of Jill having to trust Aslan and drink the water and then being given the signs. I hope they don't do it, kind of going back to Manisa's email where he asked about did BBC do a good job. I don't think they did a very good job because Jill in that scene actually says, oh, I see, I have to trust you. No, it's like, don't just come out and say it. Convey it. Make me feel the power of it. Don't just tell me.
Right.
So it's very important. This needs to be a long scene that kind of gets the ball rolling, not just on the plot, but also on the emotional heart of it, which is Jill learning to trust. Don't just skim over this.
The thing is that this will be a new introduction to Aslan. And so it's even more necessary for them to see this as, here, we're going to introduce the character of Aslan to Jill / the viewer reader.
Yeah, because it'll have been several years since the Dawn Treader movie, so right. it almost is sort of a reboot, sort of a reintroduction again, either way. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So Jill has her task. She has the four signs. She doesn't know anything about Rillian. She doesn't know it's Caspian. Not that those names would mean anything to her anyway, even if she did. And then she's Aslan blows her away, not before emphasizing you have to know the signs word for word exactly, and say them to yourself day and night. You know, when you sleep, blah, when you wake up, blah blah blah. Emphasizes the importance of that,
mm-hmm.
and then starts blowing her to Narnia. And so she's what's the thing where she says, "Oh well, fancy sleeping on air. I wonder if anyone's done it before. Oh bother, I bet Scrub has." And
yeah.
That's a great human detail, I think. Uh-huh. That. If you'd been there, you probably would have thought that. Like, wow, what if anyone's ever slept on air before? It just gives it a sense of realism, I think, about the characters.
Yeah. I love how it's sort of funny that Jill, hears all these amazing things happening to her. And, of course, Aslan kind of ignores her at the cliff. And then when she meets up with Eustace, he just kind of brushes her off. Shh, listening.
Listen to me. Someone please listen to me. And, of course, if Eustace had listened to her, or maybe if Jill had been a little more bold and grabbed him by his shoulders and said, look, You have to meet an old and dear friend of yours. Of course, I always wonder about that, because how could he have known that that was Caspian? I guess they could have gone in amongst the crowd and asked, wait, who is that? But that'd be a really difficult thing to know. And of course, if Jill had gotten there sooner, you know, like if they had heard the signs together and not she not nearly murdered Eustace, then the chances are much greater that they wouldn't have muffed the first sign. They could have gotten there sooner and met Caspian before he left.
It's like every time I read it, it's so frustrating. If only they hadn't.
And you read it again. Maybe this time.
Yeah.
Maybe this time. They'll actually meet Caspian this time, and they'll have whatever help he was going to give them. By the way, I really like how when Jill is floating back towards Narnia, it's sort of she's going back towards the islands we saw in Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a. I don't know. It's like a
fan tease, you know, like if you know what to look for, you know what she's seeing.
Well, because Lewis actually writes, you know, Jill
he
and Jealous.
It in the book.
Jill actually said old Eustace had actually landed on some of those islands, and so it's cool, you know. Voyage of the Dawn Treader, we sail east to Ascend Country, and then in the Silver Chair, we start in Ascend Country and we go back west towards Narnia. I think that's really cool.
I just love how the sense you get in Ascend Country is that. I love the sense of how massive it is. You know, it's like Aslan's country.
Cliff is to be
it's
compared.
Not like Aslan's little house. It's Aslan's country, and you get this sense of just this immense size to it.
That
just
beyond imagination.
It's that is bigger and better than anything, but especially bigger than anything you'd seen before.
Mm-hmm. So they're watching Caspian's speech. They can't really hear it that well, and then Glimfeather comes along and. Do you think it's a little cheesy how he says words that end in ooh all the time? Oh, too true, but who are you? There's something magic about you two. I saw you arrive, you flew. Everyone else seemed to be busy seeing the king off, but that nobody knew, except me. I happened to notice you, you flew.
Yeah.
I always thought that was a little bit cheesy.
I don't know, maybe if it actually sounded like an owl talking.
It's not so bad in the book, because it's a little more... You probably have to read it for a while and go, wait a second, you know, you kind of notice after you read it for a while, so it's a little more subtle, but like whenever I hear it on tape,
the
or
BBC
I suspect,
version.
Yeah, it's in the movie, it's really obvious, oh, I get it.
You flew.
Right. So I say, if they're going to do this in the movie, just have him say it how you would normally say it, you know, don't emphasize the oohs, you know, just say it. Then it can be something that maybe you pick up on, oh, I get it, he's always saying ooh, he's an owl. I think it'll be cheesy if they make too big a deal out of it. And distracting as well.
I don't know. I guess you see it along the lines of the Derek Jacobi Reepy Cheep, eh?
Maybe a little bit, yeah. Okay, we get it. He's a mouse. We get it.
He's tiny. He's super tall.
I really like, we meet Trumpkin again. Trumpkin wasn't in Dawn Treader. He skipped a book, and now he's back in Silver Chair. And I love the line where he's shouting, you know, nobody's been killed. And what do you mean coming all this way to tell me nobody's been killed? Why should anyone have been killed? So there's some great humor there.
Yeah.
So then they get up to Cair Pervel. And Lewis has an interesting tease for the next book. Why don't you go ahead and read that?
And when all the serious eating and drinking was over, a blind poet came forward and struck up the grand old tale of Prince Cor and Aravis and the horse Bree, which is called The Horse and His Boy, and tells them an adventure that happened in Narnia and in Calormen and the lands between in the golden age when Peter was high king in Cair Pervel. I haven't time to tell it now, though it is well worth hearing. And I think actually Lewis had written and finished The Horse and His Boy before... He wrote Silver Chair.
He had not published it, but he had written it, so he knew that clearly. He knew that he was going to be releasing it pretty soon. This is Silver Chair has published his book 4, Horse's Boy was published his book 5. So, and I'll just say it: if you read it in chronological order, the Horse's Boy is book 3, Silver Chair is book 6. So right here, Lewis is teasing a book that you read 3 books ago. So this is another example of something that makes a lot more sense if you read it in the original publication order. Just say that. I love another little great human detail at the beginning of chapter 4, where Lewis says, "It is a very funny thing that the sleepier you are, the longer you take about getting to bed. This was certainly true of me all the time, even last night, honestly. I'm really sleepy, and I just keep thinking, oh, I really should get ready for bed, but I'm too tired to get ready for bed.
So I was the same way. It took me about an hour to actually get to sleep.
Because you're so tired, you don't want to get ready for bed. And it's little tiny throwaway human details like that that just make you, even though maybe the characters aren't as fleshed out as in other books, just little Lewis is so good at giving you little things like that to make you go, oh, this is a real person.
Would you have preferred Lewis tell the tale of Prince Rillian? Do you like, because he did the same thing in Prince Caspian, where you hear about Caspian from a character telling the main characters. Do you prefer the stories being told a lot more like that, or more like it is here from Glenfeather? Well, not Glenfeather, but the old Wise Owl.
Yeah, so we're at the Parliament of Owls because, you know, Glenfeather came and snuck her out of Caer Parvel. I love the bit about, the excitement of a midnight escape. And that she flies on Glenfeather to the Parliament of Owls, and that's where they tell the story of Prince Rillian. Because before this, we just knew it was a prince. We didn't really know who it was or the details. I like the mystery of, first off, to tell it, it'd be hard to tell it chronologically. You'd have to have some kind of prologue or something before we meet Jill. I like not knowing the details of, like, wait, who's the prince? Who's the king? And, like, again, the signs work really well as a great hook for the series. Like, wait, the writing on the stone, what's that going to be like? Asking you to do something, the name of Aslan, well, what are the circumstances that's going to make that possible? And so I like the prince, you know, where is he? And so I like the fact that there's a lot of mystery and intrigue, and he hooks right. You with that, then starts filling in the details.
I'll ask that later.
Fine, okay.
I was going to jump to the third from the last chapter, but I won't. Quick question. Did you have an emotional response reading? Because you, of course, have read the first stories, and it doesn't... Were you sad when you found out that Caspian's wife died? Like, did you have an did it hit you emotionally?
A little bit, yeah. You know, because I remember... She never even had a name. You never got to know her
right.
that well.
I remember, but... for me, it... Reading the book, it kind of hit me. When I watched the BBC film... I had zero emotional impact in all of that. Like,
well, I remember it took me a few seconds to kind of connect. Oh yeah, yeah. That was Armandu's daughter. Yeah. You know, to connect it back to Dawn Treader. Once I realized that, yeah, and Lewis writes, she was bitterly mourned by all Narnia. So yeah, I definitely think it did a little bit. There's another. I'll tell you what really. Did hit me emotionally is the scene that I could totally see them cutting out of the movie. Maybe they'll have to, but it's where Drinian admits to Caspian, it's because of me, it's because of my silence that Rillian is gone now, and Caspian's about to kill him in anger, then stops, and he says, I have lost my queen and my son, shall I lose my friend also? And he fell upon the Lord Drinian's neck and embraced him, and both wept, and their friendship was not broken. That's such a little moment that you probably... couldn't quite justify having in the flow of a story, but I wish they could somehow. I wish they could establish that Drinian and Caspian have a friendship. I don't know. It'd be really hard to do.
For the book, it's not lost on the reader for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, then they decide they need to take them to one of the Marsh Wiggles if they want to find the lost prince. And
there's so much there that we'll have to leave that for the next episode.
Absolutely. We get to my favorite character, Puddle Glum. I think almost immediately I knew he was going to be one of my favorite characters. Okay, I need to stop. Well, at the beginning of the next episode, we'll go into Puddle Glum.
Yeah, again, you guys can contact us. We finally got Glumpuddle on Twitter.
Yes.
He is finally on Twitter, at Glumpuddle. I'm on Twitter, at Prince_Rillian. And we have a new email that you can all use. It's podcast@narniweb.com. You can send us questions, feedback, praise, glory, thanks, all that good stuff. And if you
want to
record yourself, again, try to keep it to about 60 seconds or less. Record a question where you say your name or your NarniWeb handle, rather.
Whatever you want.
Whatever you want, yeah. And send your question to us via audio file. You can email it to us at the podcast@narniweb.com email. And if some of you are wondering, hey, how do I email a file? If you have trouble emailing larger files, you can go to usendit.com.
It's actually hightail.com now.
How do you spell that?
Hightail, HIGHTAIL, hightail.com.
Okay. Yeah, you can go there, and it's a pretty simple process if you need to upload a larger file and then send someone a link to download in case any of you, because I know that my email back in the day used to have a problem with certain file sizes.
Yeah, the audio files are usually pretty small, so
yeah,
it shouldn't
be a
big
problem.
Issue. And again, it can be 60 seconds or maybe a little longer, or it can be A really quick 10-second one like Jim Fan. So whatever you want to do.
Yep. Cool.
All right, so the beginning of our very well-timed Silverchair book commentary. Just beginning.
Just starting off the new year right.